From the Passover Haggadah to the Mishnah and Back, An Introduction to Rabbinic Literature with Rabbi Reuven Cohn, Part 5. This recording is copyright by Reuven Cohn and released under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, including printed material to follow along with the class, go to www.reuvencohn.com. That's www.reuvencohn.com.
So we've been talking about that, you know, this course gives you a lot to talk about, a lot to think about. In the past, when I have taught chapter 10 of Psachim, Mishnah chapter 10, I get two reactions, two opposite reactions, sometimes from the same person. First reaction is, wow, look how little has changed since the year 200. Second reaction, wow, look how much has changed since the year 200. So in the last class, we were focusing on how little has changed, the four questions, but at the same time, how much has changed? Because according to the manuscript tradition of the Mishnah, those four questions used to be
three.
And somebody mentioned that that kind of comes as a surprise, because the four questions seems to go, that number four seems to go so nicely with other elements of the evening. Mm-hmm. And so, which really illustrates that the most successful changes, well, can you finish that sentence? What are the most successful changes in this tradition?
The ones that stay.
Yeah, well, that's almost a truism. The ones, so I'll rephrase it, the ones that have staying power, why did four questions catch on so nicely?
Because it repeated the number that was in other elements.
Right, right. So that is actually a paradigm. When we feel discontent with the Haggadah that's presented to us, that the most powerful changes, most meaningful changes, will be the ones that grow out of a strong awareness of all the components of the Seder. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we also talked about, we talked about Mishnah 3, which could be read conventionally. Oh, it fits in perfectly between Mishnah 2 and Mishnah 4. Mishnah 2, the Kiddush. Mm-hmm. Mishnah 4,
the questions
and the rest of the Maggid. Mm-hmm. Mishnah 3, ceremonial food. And then we entertained the very likely possibility that Mishnah 3 was not the ceremonial involvement with food,
but the meal.
It was the meal. And that, so in other words, the meal came before the talking. And probably people would be afraid to tell their assembled guests that. Why?
They might eat and run.
Yes, right. Because in a way, it sounds like the old way would have solved the perennial problem of that annoying question, when are we gonna eat? Okay, but opening ourselves up to the possibility that in the year 200 they ate and then they talked, that leads you to all sorts of interesting questions. For example, if they ate and then they talked, why did they change the system? That had to be a big change in its time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, if we think of our kids not letting us change little things that they've become attached to, mm-hmm. you can imagine what a to-do it was to get that change. So what did we come up with in terms of why, why they made that change from eat first to talk first? I guess it wasn't as interesting a question as I thought it was.
No. Obviously, it's easy. People may have paid attention more and been more involved before they were overstuffed and tired from a big meal and four cups of wine. Well, it's not four cups.
So now that leads us to something else, which is what was the Seder like in Second Temple times? And we entertained a very interesting possibility that in Second Temple times, the Seder was all eating and very little talking. That it was a ritual. By eating the sacred meat, you were absorbing the sacred story. Okay. Now, that would explain nicely why, with the destruction of the temple, when they're reestablishing themselves and they think back to the temple times, what was the main thing of the evening? Eating. So probably post-temple, it's Passover again. Let's sit down and do what?
Eat.
And, maybe we better add something on after we eat. So it's likely that the reason for eat first, talk later is because that was replacing eat only. Okay. Now.
I think it changed.
Okay. So you ask your question again.
When do you think the tradition changed?
Okay. So we have entertained a possibility. And we are starting, we'd like to note the entrance of Elijah into the room.
For those on tape, somebody wasn't here, just walked in.
What do you mean somebody? Okay. When do you think it changed? Okay. The Mishnah, the year 200, it might still have been eat first, talk later. Now, we have not yet defined another important term. We talked about Mishnah. We need to talk about, and what is Mishnah? Before I pop the next term?
Compilation of the laws.
Of laws, a five-generation project from the year 70 to approximately the year 200. Okay, punctuated right in the middle by the Bar Kokhba rebellion. Okay, and from that perspective, the Mishnah aims to take what can be found in the Torah and make it a blueprint for survival under new conditions. Okay, with a heavy emphasis on the law, what you gotta do. Okay, now, if you turn back to page 2, you have the five generations of the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is promulgated in Galilee. Then, the Mishnah doesn't become the Mishnah overnight. The Mishnah was destined to be second to the Bible. But that doesn't happen overnight. But you have groups of rabbis who are dedicated to making the Mishnah into the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. And their study focuses on the Mishnah. They're interested in explaining it, in promulgating it, in keeping it relevant. And something interesting happens. I'm going to tell you a story. The fifth generation in the Galilee, the most prominent member of that fifth generation is Rabbi Judah the Prince. In Hebrew, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Also known as just Rabbi or Rebbe. Okay? Now, some scholars from Babylonia come to study with Rabbi Judah the Prince in the Galilee. One of them is a tall young man named Abba. Interesting name. And he had a nickname. Abba Aricha. What's that? He was tall. Aroch is actually long. So Abba Aricha is a student in the Galilee. He's Babylonian. There are a few Babylonians who have been drawn, Babylonian Jews who've been drawn to Galilee. Okay. Now, in the year 987, someone in Baghdad writes a history in 987 in which he reports the following. In the year 219, how old is the Mishnah in the year 219? A couple of decades, right? In the year 219, Abba Aricha returned to Babylon. There he founded a yeshiva. And at that point, Babylonian Jewry rises on the Richter scale. Okay? So Abba Aricha, he's forever after known by the name Rav, is the first generation of the post-Mishnah rabbis in Babylon. Meanwhile, there are plenty of post-Mishnah rabbis in the Galilee. In both centers, they're embarking on a new multi-generational project, which is keep the Mishnah current, keep it alive, keep it understood. Five generations later in the Galilee, they produce a Gemara. Eight generations later in Babylon, they produce a different version of the Gemara.
Right.
But even though this was all before the era of our internet communication, they only had dial-up at that time, people went back and forth between the two centers.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so both centers produce a Gemara, and in each case,
oral.
A Gemara, at first oral, eventually probably memorized, and then finally written down. And here's an equation. Mishnah plus Gemara equals Talmud. Now, usually the terms Gemara and Talmud are practically interchangeable because, the Gemara means the multi-generational commentary on the Mishnah, but it always goes hand in hand with the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. So these terms sometimes get blurred, smished.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. The Gemara of Babylon is called the Babylonian Talmud Bavli. And what's the Gemara of the Galilee called?
Yerushalmi.
Yeah. Why is it called Talmud Yerushalmi if it's Galilean? After the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, as a result of the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, the Jewish settlement in Judea around Jerusalem is devastated. And so Jews in the Galilee have a strong awareness, not only is the temple destroyed, but thanks to the Bar Kokhba Rebellion, we can't even be in the neighborhood anymore. And so I've got to believe when they call this new Talmud the Jerusalem Talmud, out of respect, out of longing, out of connection.
Mm-hmm.
I still remember. So, which became the prominent The Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. I still remember my wonderful seventh grade teacher, Rabbi Wolgemuth, who introduced us to the Talmud. And he says at some point, there's a Talmud Bavli and there's a Talmud Yerushalmi, and we're going to study the Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud. And I remember as a seventh grader saying, this doesn't compute. Mm-hmm. Who cares about Babylonia? All of our focus is on Jerusalem, Israel. Why aren't we studying the Jerusalem Talmud? Mm-hmm. I have no recollection of what the answer he gave me. I just remember he was very nice and I learned a lot from him. That's a topic for another day, why the Babylonian Talmud triumphed. But I'll tell you, standing on one foot, that part of the reason the Babylonian Talmud triumphed is because Islam took over the Near East, that initially Islam is ruled out of Arabia, then there is a dynasty called the Umayyads who rule out of Damascus, then in 750 there's a new dynasty, the Abbasids. This is more than you want to hear right now. The Abbasids, who rule out of Baghdad. And at that time, 90% of world Jewry is under Islam. And so 90% of world Jewry is looking to the capital of Babylonia, where the political power resides. Mm-hmm. And so now, I had mentioned that Rav, the tall guy, had founded a yeshiva in Sura. I didn't mention that it was in Sura, around the year 219. Around the year 800, that yeshiva moved to Baghdad. This is like if Harvard were to move from Cambridge to Somerville. We all know what would happen. If Harvard moved from Cambridge to Somerville, it would rename Somerville as Cambridge. Right. And so here, we'll edit that because they, you don't mess with Harvard. Oh, my God. So imagine a venerable yeshiva has such a pedigree in Sura picking up and moving to Baghdad because there was a need to be near where the political power was. And though that yeshiva was an advocate of the Babylonian Talmud. So that, in a nutshell, may explain why the Babylonian Talmud triumphs. Now, why am I talking about this? You asked when the change comes about. What change are we talking about?
When the Magid is told before the meal.
When the telling of the story switches to before the meal. Okay. In order to determine that, we would have to do a careful study of the Babylonian Talmud and of the Jerusalem Talmud. Okay? To see what are the hints as to when that took place. It took place sometime during the period of the Gemara. By the time the Gemara is concluded, it's pretty clear that Magid is the way we know it. Okay? But more than that, I can't say right now. The Gemara is more complicated to parse than is the Mishnah, because the Mishnah got a very fine-tuned editing in which where there was clearly a desire to make everything consistent with everything else. In the Gemara, there's much more of a sense of the multiple generations speaking with in different pitch. Okay? So is that an answer?
Yeah, that's very helpful.
Okay. In a way, that answer is there's more to study when we're through studying.
So does that also mean that the time when the Bavli was being written in Babylonia and then moving to the capital of
Babylon
and
back,
that those were good times for the Jews in that part of the world. Safe times, times when obviously we flourished intellectually, but were we flourishing?
Okay, so are you...
was it a good time?
So the great Jewish historian of the 20th century was Salo Baron at Columbia, and he used a fancy word. He talked about how people are drawn to the lachrymose concept of Jewish history. Lachrymose is a fancy schmancy word. You know what fancy schmancy means.
I do know fancy schmancy.
lachrymose for tearful. You know that we grab perhaps because of the he wrote this in 1928.
Wow.
Before the lacra really got mosing.
Right.
Okay. But, and it's really fascinating to read the article when you know this ain't nothing compared to what's coming up. But yes, a Jewish society in Baghdad in the 9th century was a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Was a good time. Much of Jewish society was hierarchical in the manner in which Islamic society was hierarchical. And you had leaders in Baghdad who were called Gaonim, and it's the Gaonic period.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Cairo Geniza was discovered in the 19th century, all of a sudden there was so much information on the trade and the way Jews earned their livings.
Mm-hmm.
You had a probably... 9th century Baghdad can be compared only to 20 and 21st century America. It's really quite a fascinating period. And I'll mention a very short book, Raymond Scheindlin, professor at Jewish Theological Seminary, A Short History of the Jewish People. It's short. He lives up to... he has maybe two or three pages on the Gaonic period that just...
really hits it.
Really, yes. Thank you. Okay. Now, we have... all this is interesting. We need to know more. We've been talking about the Maggid switching places with the meal. We need to know more about Maggid, the storytelling in the year 200. So for that, we need to turn to chapter 10, Mishnah 4 again. And before I ask you to read, let me ask you to read the first four lines, which is the four lines that precede the Manishtana. Okay, it's page 18. Okay.
They poured for him the second cup, and here the son asks his father. And if the son does not have understanding, the father teaches him.
Okay. So I would like to look at the Hebrew. The im ein da'at babain. If there is no knowledge in the son, then how many more words do we have left?
Two.
Aviv melamdo. Very simple Hebrew. Now, what do we learn from this? At this point, before the questions have been asked, how many types of children are there?
There are two.
There are children who have da'at and children who don't. Okay? The one who has da'at, father doesn't have to teach the questions to. Fine. Then come the questions. Now I'll ask you, when you're through with the questions, two more lines. The two lines that follow the questions. Yeah, next.
He begins with...
And saying, according?
And according to the understanding of the son, his father teaches him.
Okay. So, Hebrew. Ulefi da'ato shel ben. What's the next two words?
Aviv melamdo.
Aviv melamdo.
So it's the same words.
Same two words. But what are we talking about here at this point in the Mishnah? We've had the four questions. And now we're told, according to the understanding of the Son, the Father teaches him. What's to be taught at this point in the Mishnah? We've had the questions.
The answers.
The answers. And when you're dealing with answers, how many types of children are there?
Many types.
Many. An infinite number. Because you're supposed to teach each kid
according
to who that kid is. So this is the kernel of the concept that in our Haggadah, we play this out by talking about, we're not going to talk about the infinite number of children. Mm-hmm. What do we talk about?
The four.
Four types. And that is, the Jerusalem Talmud, in discussing these lines in the Mishnah, say, oh, this is, it quotes a passage about the four sons. This is the whole concept of the four sons. And that's probably why that whole passage about the four sons comes into our recital. Okay? Now, so in the first case you say Aviv Melamdo, but you mean the father teaches him questions. In the second instance you say Aviv Melamdo, and you mean answers. We are seeing the intense sparseness of the Mishnah. Okay? And why is it so sparse?
Just you've got to remember it.
Yes. So I always like to ask people to humor me and try to memorize a Mishnah paragraph. Now, memorization has gotten a bad name because of Mrs. Palmer, our fourth grade teacher, who forced us to memorize. And that was considered to be, that's very old-fashioned, right? You had to memorize by rote. But if you try to memorize this, you end up getting closer to the source. It's only when I myself try to memorize this that I noticed, oh my God, look how few words are used. Now, let's take, before it says Aviv Melamdo, in the first instance, it says, according to, if the child has...
No understanding.
Okay. What are the key words in the Hebrew? Im is if. Ain. Ain is not. Those are such basic words. Mm-hmm. And then you have the word da'at and the word bain, son. Now you go down below and you have
ulafi,
lafi, according to, a little preposition. And then you have da'at again and bain. So you have... the same building blocks before the question and after the question, okay? And by the time come to this point, we have what we would consider a very modern pedagogic approach.
That's true.
Yes.
There's also a certain beauty in it, in that it creates an equality among all kinds of children.
Yeah.
Because I know what always disturbed me, it still continues to disturb me, is the four designations that it's turned out to be, which perhaps we'll chat about or not. But here, it's much more of an equality. A child sharing know your daily shul is the same as you might have.
Okay, so this is very nice. Mm-hmm. I've always been bothered by the four sons. I was always the chacham, and I knew there was a big price you pay when you're the chacham, because people resent you.
Oh.
You're an elitist.
Right.
In
a culture that values chacham.
Yeah, so what you're saying, but I think the people who articulated the four sons, they were drawing on this, their heart was in the right place, and that's how it's meant to be read. Give every kid his due. That's what's fun about going back to the Mishnah's version, because then you can say, oh, I don't know about the four sons, but the Mishnah clearly says
all children are deserving of an answer and are able to ask a question. Are
Yeah. Well,
you deserve to get the respect and the attention
yes.
of the father
yes.
in a certain way.
Yes.
Each
yes.
kid gets taught according to its IEP.
You know,
right?
Requirement.
Yes.
It's a requirement.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Were you going to? Okay. Now, we now need, so we spent a lot of time on this simple Hebrew, Lefi Da'ato Shelben Aviv Melamdo, the father teaches him. So basically, the Mishnah, what has the Mishnah just devoted real estate to? How would you characterize those few words?
The obligation of the father, parenting.
Yes, parenting, and it's a how-to.
Mm-hmm.
This is it's not content. It's
process.
Now, you said a moment ago, it's an obligation. I want to point something else out about Mishnah. Mishnah does not shout. Mishnah doesn't say the father is obligated to teach to. What does it do? Instead of saying it as an order, how does it say it? As if it were merely a
process.
Yeah, but a description.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right.
That's okay. what he does. Mm-hmm. But that's the rhetoric of the Mishnah. Now, I again recall I was reading a book by Hyman McCoby, a scholar in England, in which he said I don't remember exactly, but it was basically that the Mishnah has a gentle voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what? I never noticed before. Why don't we notice the Mishnah's gentle voice?
Weapon.
Okay, let the record state, I didn't say that, but that's a Mishnaic precise way to put it. Which text does raise its voice?
The Torah raises.
Yes, yes, and perhaps the editor of the Mishnah. Now, let's not fool ourselves. It doesn't raise its voice, but the expectation is there. And so perhaps the editor of the Mishnah doesn't raise his voice because he knows...
People won't listen if he does.
No, yeah, no. But where I was heading is he knows that the Torah does the voice raising. So the...
Oh, good cup, bad cup.
Yeah. Did you say good cup, bad cup?
Yeah, that's exactly what I said.
Yes, okay. So now, so we've just had some process, and now we're going to have another line of process. Next.
He begins with shame and concludes with praise and explains.
One line, just that line. He begins with shame and concludes with praise. Now... This is a famous line.
Well, we were struggling with it this morning in our group.
Okay. So. Yeah. So maybe I shouldn't have used the word shame. Matchil bigenut umesayim b'shevach. Okay. Now, this is a little flowery. Here we have the Gemara helping us out. Okay. And in fact, Rav, whom I mentioned earlier, talks about this in the Gemara, as does many of the rabbis of the Gemara have a sparring partner, person with whom they're always arguing, and then both views are generally recorded. So Rav's sparring partner was Samuel. And basically, they're both in agreement that the shame, this is not about shaming the kid. That's not what it's about. It's when you tell the story, start with the part of the story that is...
The shame that Israel was...
The shame. And end with the part of the story that is...
Praising God.
Praising God. Yes. Why? If we misread it, it's because we are so accustomed to our modern lingo of we praise our children, our predecessors...
Shame.
Did not. That's not That's not the lingo here. This is about when you teach the history, start with the shameful past, go to the glory. Okay. Now, for that, we need to turn to the Haggadah.
So by shame, you're actually saying powerlessness.
Yes.
Of it.
Yes. Yes.
What other word could you have used besides shame?
You help me.
No, in terms of the Hebrew.
The Hebrew.
In terms of the Hebrew.
Okay, so, this word, genut, has another form, genai. Mm-hmm. So, lignai, it's something negative, something you're not proud of. Mm-hmm. Okay, now, let's turn to the Maggid. Now, we've just finished the four questions. And let's look at 5-1 and 7-1. Let's remind ourselves of those two. 5-1, we were slaves in Egypt. Avadim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim. And God took us out. And what's 7-1? Mitchila. 7-1.
Of the Avodah Zarah.
Yeah, which is?
Idolaters.
We were idolaters, and now,
we what are
we? We're monotheists. Okay, not only are we monotheists, we got monotheism to catch on big. Okay, so now, Rav and Samuel in the Babylonian Talmud puzzle over this phrase, start with shame and end with praise. Samuel says, start with shame, we were slaves. End with praise, God took us out. That's Samuel. Rav says, start with shame, our ancestors were idolaters. End with praise.
Wow. Uh-huh.
Now we are not. Okay. Cool. Now, if you look at the Haggadah called the Participation Haggadah, nice Haggadah, published by the Hartman Institute, they will say, here's Samuel's version of the answer, here's Rav's version of the answer. Okay? And they're basically, one is saying, they're both agreeing, we're talking history tonight. We're going back to the beginning, the less proud beginning, when we weren't what we are now. And one says, talk about the physical slavery, and the other says, talk about
the emotional, psychic slavery.
Yeah, yeah. Or intellectual slavery, if you want to put it that way. Okay.
Well, is it slavery so much as intellectual, perhaps lack of enlightenment?
Yes. You use slavery because it's, after all, Passover,
and slavery
is a Passover word.
Right.
Yes.
But
this
is the one place where perhaps one is troubled by political correctness, in that when one does go to what would be considered idolatry type societies such as India, the theology is actually perhaps could be interpreted as monotheistic, or maybe that's a modern interpretation, but it is remarkable how similar the customs are.
So what are you saying? If you're in India on Passover, maybe you'll just do it whose way? Samuel's way. Samuel was a fine person. So next year, well, when we're in Jerusalem, we'll do it Rav's way. Yeah. No, this is an interesting question. I'll tell you where it came up so recently. Think, speak. I'll tell you later. When
those children always keep you.
Yeah, yeah. No, we are very, that's a very good comment, because we are very accustomed to living in a society where everyone speaks of the great three monotheistic traditions.
Right.
And in fact, if we can get someone to acknowledge there are three, they're already being so open to many, many stimuli. And you're saying it's more complicated than that. Okay, now, let's think a moment about, so Rav and Samuel, they're the first generation after the Mishnah, and they're arguing about a line in the Mishnah. And but it, which one of them is correct about what the Mishnah originally meant? Could you say that in a way that will be heard by our...
Verbalize my hand movements.
Your hands.
Yes.
Well, we could describe the hands.
Right.
Yeah.
Either one could be correct.
Well, I think they're both seen as correct because they both made it into the Magid, no?
Oh, so this is very interesting. This is very interesting. In the Haggadah is a form of liturgy. Generally speaking, Mishnah and the Gemara preserve multiple points of view. They preserve them, both are to be studied and remembered. But if you have to decide if it's about, do you owe the money to him or does he owe the money to you? So you have to decide which way, which of the two you will follow, even though you continue to respect and study both points of view. With respect to liturgy, there was a tendency, if you have an argument, if you were to rule in favor of one, the other would probably be lost forever, and therefore, if possible, find a place for each. So, in the Amidah, there was an understanding from the Mishnah that the last blessing of the Amidah was a blessing for peace. Then, in the Gemara, they're having some discussion. One version starts, Sim Shalom, and the other version, Shalom Rav. So, what does the tradition ultimately do with those two variations?
Split the difference in various services. One for one service, one for the
other. Yeah, one for the morning, one for the evening. Okay. And what about the afternoon service? Chassidim use the morning one. Everyone else uses the evening one. Okay. There are a number of such examples. And so it's not altogether surprising that the Haggadah incorporates both points of view. Now, why does it incorporate them in this particular order? First, Samuel, we were slaves. And only later on, starting over with Rav, we were idolaters. Mm-hmm. If it were doing it chronologically, because the idolater is remembered as the father of Abraham. Mm-hmm. I actually find this, we were idolaters, the power that it has for me is from having participated in German-Jewish dialogue groups. And in German, these are self-selected groups. Everybody who comes has decided that this is something they want to grapple with. But there is an inherent inequality in the group. The Jews are, for the most part, children of Holocaust survivors, and they are proud. They are proud of their ancestors. The Germans who have come, who are admirable people for having undertaken this, for weeks and weeks and weeks, they're just interested to hear what the Jews have to say. And Jews will talk if you let them. And really, take quite a while before they're able to talk about their own ancestors. And in one group, I question people. I said, what's going on here? I want to hear what you have to say. And someone said, well, you can be proud of your ancestors, but I can't be proud of mine. Mm-hmm. And there was something, I,
if someone was showing up for a German Jewish dialogue group, had a right to be proud and could find something to be proud of. And so the Rav approach, we were idolaters, it's a wonderful corrective to any smugness that we might fall into. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're proud of this, mm-hmm. but things weren't always this way. Okay, so that's really a personal aside how I relate to that. Now, I had asked you which of the two was correct. And you said, my hands say, oh. I can't really determine that. Yeah? Did you want to...
Well, I guess in the Mishnah, my eye is taken to the next place.
Which we're not there yet.
Which seems to refer to this discussion. But.
Okay, so we'll come to that in a moment. I'll give you
another... Did this come up once before where the order did say something about which one was the...
I raised that question. So here's an answer my father gave to that particular question at the Seder about why do you put we were slaves first? Mm-hmm. He said, if we put we were idolaters first, then by the time you come to the next version, that would not seem like a new beginning because you're just continuing the chronology. Uh-huh. So if you want to make a statement that I'm doing two different concepts of history, you must do the slavery first, and then when you come to the idolatry, it's clear, oh, I'm stepping back in time. Mm-hmm. This is something new.
I see in my mind a rock painting of the you know, where things are discontinuous, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and you notice them more, or mm-hmm. That motion.
Yep. Now, I'm going to suggest, I asked you, who captured the original intent of the Mishnah? Was it Rav or was it Samuel? And I'm going to say neither did. That the original intent of this Mishnah was pop, organize your material. Start with shame, end with praise. It was an open-ended instruction. It didn't require a specific recital. And Rav and Samuel, each one is reporting on a specific paragraph, which ends up in our Haggadah and becomes a ritual recital rather than an inquiry into a historical process. Now, can we recreate the Mishnah and give ourselves the instruction, start with shame and end with praise, and not bother with 5-1 or 7-1?
Well, you could start with the ignominious destruction of the temple and wind up with the Mishnah.
Okay. Well, I see you like this course. Yeah.
You could start sort of in the ontology, recapitulates phylogeny concept of we as children, you know, do, quote, shameful things, you know, we defecate it wherever and so forth, and then we grow up and we come to look like.
Okay. And we don't do that anymore?
No, that's what I'm saying. Just we would be shame to glory.
Yes, yes. You know. Oh, on Tajin, yes.
Not just we as a people, but we as individuals.
But I'm going to go to a different point, which is there's a reason that we settled on ritualizing these paragraphs, because they're safe, they're comfortable, they have the stamp of timelessness, and we know what to do. It's there. But just because it's been ritualized and put in the book, you still can spend a minute on here's one approach. Here's the other approach. We can take the text which has become a ritual recital and bring it to life with really very little investment of time in that evening. Okay, now we're ready for the end of the Mishnah. It tells us, so we have a trace, of start with shame and end with praise. Two versions of that have entered our Haggadah. And what are the last few lines of the Mishnah now?
And explains from...
And who's that? Who's doing this explaining?
This is the father still.
Yeah.
From an Aramean would attack my ancestor until he completes the whole parsha.
Okay. And explains. So the father is supposed to doing is supposed to be doing some explaining. I need the Hebrew.
V'doresh me'arami
over. V'doresh. I just want that one word. Doresh. What does that word mean? Doresh. Where does it come up in our...
A drash,
which is really... That's in a... really probably more correct to say drasha. But I think we are... Americans are in a hurry, so we say drash. Okay. So what is that, a drasha or a drash?
It's a discussion. It's an explanation of some principle or...
Okay. So the word doresh... in the Bible has a very concrete meaning.
Yeah? To seek.
To seek. Okay. Now, what does to seek mean?
It means to actively investigate, to engage.
So if you're, you know, if you're just looking for something casually, that's not seeking. But so doresh means to actively search for. Okay. So that's the physical meaning. Then there are a number of places in the Tanakh in which the reference is that you are doreshing, not your donkeys that you've lost, but you're doreshing God. Okay. When Rebecca had a terribly uncomfortable pregnancy and didn't know she was bearing twins, she went lidrosh to seek out God. Okay? This is the first instance of when doctors started to think of themselves... it's because of all the lawyer jokes I'm getting. So then, as the rabbis develop as a force, and as study of scripture replaces the sacrifices, doresh comes to mean in-depth search of scripture. Okay? So a drasha is an in-depth search into scripture. Now, in the early Middle Ages, the word drash came to mean the traditional rabbinic interpretation. And Rashi led the march to find new ways of looking at the text. And eventually, people started using drash to mean, oh, the old stuff. The old stuff that we're tired of. But in the Mishnah, in the year 200, doresh is active figuring out what the text actually means. So what is this saying? What should you be doing at this point in time? According to this?
Studying the Torah.
Studying the Torah. Now, how do you study those verses? Do you have to read a specific commentary on those verses?
No, you read the verses.
You
look at the actual verses and talk
you
about them.
And yes, and you delve into them. Can everyone do that?
No.
And so what we have in the Haggadah is a standard commentary that developed in the time of the Mishnah. It wasn't part of the Mishnah, but there were standard commentaries on the legal sections of the Torah. Sometimes the term for these commentaries is Midrash Halacha. Sometimes they're called Tanaitic Midrash. And so 9, 1, 2, 3, and 4 is Tanaitic Midrash on these verses. And so, but what should we really be doing with these verses according to the Mishnah?
Reading them.
Not reading isn't enough.
Analyzing
them. Okay. Now, where are these verses from that we're supposed to be analyzing?
Deuteronomy
26. Now, the question is, there, if I remember correctly, there's a whole book. The second book is called
Exodus.
So if you rabbis of the Mishnah want us to be studying some Torah at the Seder, you would think...
Exodus.
From Exodus. What do you give me? Deuteronomy 26. So in order to get a perspective on that, we need to see Deuteronomy 26 in its context. Okay? So we'll go around the table. Everyone gets a verse. It's on the last page, 24. It's your homework. You should know where it is. Yeah. So where were we?
Me.
Okay.
First one.
Yep.
And it shall be, when you come into the land which the Lord your God gives you for an inheritance, and you possess it and dwell therein.
Yeah.
That you shall take of the first of all the fruit of the ground which you shall bring in from your land that the Lord your God gives you, and you shall put it in a basket, and you shall go to the place which the Lord your God shall choose cause his name to dwell there.
So what is that place referred to frequently in the book of Deuteronomy? The place that God shall choose?
Israel.
No.
Oh, it's the Mishkan.
You're already in Israel.
Yeah.
It's the Mishkan, the temple.
Okay.
It's Jerusalem. The temple in Jerusalem. Okay.
And you shall come to the priest who shall be in those days, and you shall say to him, I profess this day through the Lord your God, that I have come to the land which the Lord swore to our fathers to give to us.
Now, what is this ritual? There's a name for this ritual. This is the first fruit ritual.
The Bikurim.
The Bikurim. Okay. Now, it's interesting. The verse sounds like it's a one-time thing when you enter the land. But the tradition takes this as an annual event, that whatever crops you grow, when you have the first fruit, you bring them to Jerusalem. Now, and what do we do in Jerusalem in terms of what you just read? Verse 4, wasn't it?
No.
Verse 3.
Yeah.
What do you do when you arrive?
Take them to the priest.
And do what?
And you swear allegiance to the Lord who gave us the land.
Okay. Yes. And I profess. What's the Hebrew for I profess this day?
Higadati.
Higadati. Like our familiar Haggadah word. Mm-hmm. Now, the Torah actually reports very few prayers or statements that are required to be said. Most of the things that we say aren't stuff that the Torah says. Say it. But here you have a Haggadah. I have come this day to the land. Fine. So that's a profession. And then where do we go? What happens next? That was verse 3.
And the priest shall take the basket from your hand, and he shall set it down before the altar of the Lord your God.
Okay. So you've talked once. He responds by taking the basket of fruit. Yeah?
And you shall speak.
Next.
And you shall speak and say before the Lord your God, an Aramean astray was my ancestor, and he went down into Egypt, and he sojourned there, few in number, and he became there a nation, great, mighty, and populous.
So what is this?
The Magid.
Yeah, but what is this within its context? You have brought the first fruit.
It's the shame.
Yeah. Very interesting. You have brought the first fruit.
You've said, Higadati, I've come, I'm here. And this is your second statement. And what type of a statement is this? This is verse 5. You're recounting history.
Right.
An Aramean astray. And this is what scholars call an epitome of Jewish history. How long does it take to get through the key points? Next verse. Yeah?
And the Egyptians dealt ill with us, and they afflicted us, and they put upon us hard bondage.
Okay. Now, next verse.
And we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice, and he saw our affliction and our toil and our oppression.
Yeah, next.
And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and with an outstretched arm and with great terribleness and with signs and with wonders.
How many verses has this epitome taken so far?
Four verses.
And these are the four verses that we study in the Maggid. Somebody in the time of the Mishnah made a decision, there was a consensus, that we have to study Torah. Why do we need Torah study? Perhaps that was part, remember, there's a terrible void. There's a void that used to connect us
to God,
the sacrifice. And so we're going to study Torah, but they cut us slack. If we were to study Exodus, how many verses would it be?
Yes.
So the rabbis found four verses that they plucked out of their context that tell the whole story in a precise way. And they're saying, study these verses. Now, what about most people who sit at the Seder, by the time they come to what we have as 9-1, 9-2, 9-3, 9-4, there's been a lot of action, and people tend not to be aware that this is Torah study. And they're certainly not aware that where these verses have come from. But does the context, if you know the context of the verses, does that context do anything for you on Passover night? What is the context? The first fruit ritual. And what we do at the Seder, what about these words? What is the history of these words that we're going to study? Where have these words been? Where have they echoed?
In the temple.
And was it fancy people? Echo, who's saying this?
Regular people talking to the priest.
Huh?
Regular people talking to the priest.
It's regular people. So we have been disconnected with our past. We've been cut off from the past, and now we search the Torah and we find words that used to echo in the temple as part of a celebration of God giving us the land. Okay? And so we study those very words. We're borrowing some Bikurim energy, and we have one more way of connecting with our past. Now, are we required to know all this? We hope not, because most people don't. Can you function without knowing this connection? Yes. If you know the connection, however,
it's much richer.
There's more there. Now, we only study these four verses, but let's look at the fifth verse anyway.
Number 9.
Yeah.
And he has brought us into this place, and he has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey.
Okay. I mentioned Daniel Goldschmidt. Daniel Goldschmidt, he speculates that when Jews were living in the land of Israel, in the time of the Mishnah, And when they studied these verses, as the Mishnah said, they would study this fifth verse as well. If they were in the Galilee, they would also study, and he brought us to this place. It made sense. But what happens when they shift to Babylonia? This verse doesn't work anymore, and they leave it out. But this verse is also interesting. But what about the Mishnah? The Mishnah says, study it till the end. It's a little, the end of what? It's open-ended, and the Mishnah can allow for different possibilities. Now, if this fifth verse was studied, it would mean that the culmination of the Exodus story is
the return to Israel.
The return to Israel. And if you do it that way, then Passover is painful, because you're saying the Passover story is no longer fulfilled. But if you chop off that verse, then how is Passover story fulfilled?
Just by getting out of Egypt.
Getting out of Egypt. Let's take a moment, just a second, to look at the Dayenu. Okay. We'll pick up with the Dayenu after our break.